Okay. Okay. You're listening to Infants on Thrones with my dad.
This is Infants on Thrones. The philosophies of men mingled with humor. We are the core.
My name's Tom Perry, and welcome to another listener-submitted episode for Infants on Thrones. So as you guys and girls know, we've been accepting listener-submitted essays for a while now. And what we normally do is we'll play the essay, and then of course we'll bring the author of the essay on for some further discussion. And when we do this, as some of you loyal listeners will know, we try to stay on topic, but oftentimes unrelated tangents come upon us and then all hell breaks loose. My apologies if you don't like it when this happens, but sometimes in my opinion, this is when the true magic happens.
Ho, 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 it's magic, you know. Never believe it's not so.
So a while back, a listener submitted one particular essay, and you can imagine my surprise when I saw what he had named his essay.
My name is Jay Briner, and the name of my essay is called The Tom Psy.
Ugh. You know, I've gotten a lot of crap for this in the past. In fact, if my memory serves, someone created an actual drinking game for a Mormon-themed podcast, and my Psy was in the top 10. Can you imagine me knowing that someone was taking a shot after each of my audible Psys on past podcasts? How exactly am I supposed to get that out of my head? Ugh. So of course, some speculated that I used the Tom Psy when I was disgusted when someone used an extreme or an absolutely ridiculous example. Some say I used it when someone attacked the church or its believers. Some said I would use the Psy when someone attempted a lame or terrible joke. Glenn. And others thought it was just me being tired of the discussion. So, I felt like now's a good time to go ahead and put this mystery to bed once and for all. And the answer is, yep, you guessed it, all the above. I can't recall all the particular situations, of course, but I do know for a fact that I sigh out loud when I'm participating in podcasts or even when I'm listening to podcasts all by myself with my earbuds in. Yes, I'm that guy who reacts to what he's listening to, so if you run into me by chance, or if you see me while I'm listening to the podcast with my skull candies in, there is a good chance that you'll hear me sigh in person, live. I've even been known to use a "Oh come on," or "Oh brother," or "Right on, dude," while I'm listening to my earbuds. Yes, I've had plenty of startled stares, because, yep, that's how I roll. So back to Jay's essay, of course. We don't spend a lot of time, now that I recall, I don't think we spend any time actually talking about me or my Psy, which is a relief. He goes on to explain how he uses it as a metaphor. And as a disclaimer, I should mention that this recording is actually our second attempt, because although I like to think that I'm well-versed in the world of podcasting, our first recording didn't work because of technical issues on my end. So I want to publicly thank Jay for his patience for sitting down with me for a second time and hashing out ex-Mormons, ex-Mormon communities, believers, family and friends, and lots of other issues that those of us that are going through the transition of disaffection and unbelief deal with.
After my faith crisis, like many of you, I really came to appreciate and enjoy all the hard work and effort that people spent producing Mormon-themed podcasts. So thank you to everyone who has put time, effort, and money into putting those out there. It really did help me to not feel crazy. Thank you. Out of the many things I felt like I could relate to in those podcasts, one of the auditory landmarks that I felt I could identify with the most is the Tom Psy. You know what I'm talking about. Somebody on Mormon Expression would say something snarky or sharp, and then Tom would sigh. And depending on how the conversation was going, people would either be irritated by Tom's Psy or they would laugh at it. So I had a great experience growing up in Mormonism. My parents have their flaws, but they fall well within the bell curve that great parents fall within. My extended family is full of the kinds of people you are proud to know, and that you'd like to get to know better. If you had kids the age of my cousins, you'd want your kids to play with my cousins because they're such great kids. You'd like to live next door to my aunts and uncles because they're such great neighbors. Their goodness, it is not an act. My mission president, he was a great guy. I've heard stories of mission presidents that were just plain terrible, that treated their missionaries like crap, treated them in ways that pretty much fall into the category of psychological torture. And I can honestly say that this kind of thing never really applied to me. My mission president was great, and he's still a great guy. At BYU, I had great roommates who were classy people. They have classy families now, and in fact, a couple of years ago, my BYU freshman ward got together for a BYU 50th ward reunion. A bunch of us, including me, scheduled our family vacations so that we would happen to be in Utah that week, and it was really great to see everyone. In my profession, facilities management, it is not a stretch to say that generally the BYU graduates are much better than the non-BYU graduates. Even though I'm no longer in facilities management, I can still say that if you are going to hire a facilities manager, there is really only one thing to do: hire a BYU grad. I say this as a full-fledged apostate. The corporation and I are finished. But Mormons, salt of the earth. I mean that sincerely. My grandparents, both of my grandfathers were chemists, and both of my grandmothers were teachers. Both sets of grandparents had a lot of kids, all of whom are kind and generous people. All four of my grandparents got their bachelor's degrees. My mom's dad is a perfect example of someone who consecrated his life to the corporation, to the LDS corporate benefit. He was head chemist at the assay office in Murray, Utah. There's a Costco there now, but for those of you who remember, there used to be this giant smokestack in Murray, and that's where my grandpa worked. He had 30 or so chemists working under him. He was a respected person in the community. He raised millions of dollars for the Boy Scouts. He was on the board for his local hospital and raised money to build one of the wings. One year, the nurses at that hospital went on strike, and Grandpa was in the meetings where they were negotiating with the nurses. When each side broke off to talk amongst themselves, Grandpa effectively said, "I think we should give the nurses what they're asking for. We've got the money. It's worth it." And the nurses got their raise, and the strike ended. Grandpa was stake president at the time. In fact, Grandpa helped build the building where the Murray Third Ward meets. It's that church building right behind the BMW dealership off of State Street. For a couple of years, Grandpa would get home from work and go lead a construction crew to build that building. One year in state conference, he announced he wasn't going to shave his beard until the building was funded. One of those fun local public relations stunts. Okay, I could go on and on. I could talk about my grandfather, it's a wonderful lifestyle, saving the local credit union. I could tell a lot of stories like that. I came from four wonderful grandparents. I got 25% of my DNA from each of those four people. That means 100% of my DNA comes from devout Mormons. And I'm proud of where I come from. I'm proud of that DNA. So when Tom is sighing on those podcasts, I'm sighing right there along with him. Because when I think of Mormons, these are the people I think of. They have nothing to be ashamed of. They are totally fine exactly the way they are. They don't need to change to be okay with me. At the same time, I am finished with the LDS Corporation. I'm not going back. I haven't resigned yet on paper, but I've resigned in my heart. I see the corporation as an extension of Joseph Smith's marital vows. The corporation is like a lying, cheating spouse who expects 100% fidelity from the faithful spouse, but doesn't deliver fidelity or even honesty in return. It's this tension I hear in Tom's sigh. It's like you have this really cool neighbor whose spouse is cheating, but if you tell this neighbor that about the spouse's infidelity, your relationship to the person changes. It could really get awkward. Anyway, I don't want to get bogged down into comparing the LDS Corporation to a lying, cheating spouse, even though I think it's a fair comparison. So here's my best effort to articulate the emotion of the Tom sigh. It's this awful position we, the disaffected, are put into. On one hand, we have this high regard for these wonderful people in our lives. On the other hand, when we blow the whistle on the corporation, it changes our relationship with these wonderful people, and it's painful, and it isn't fair. It isn't something we want. It took me a while to notice that pretty much everyone in the disaffected community has their own version of the Tom-Sai. Even outspoken critics, for example, I'll give you examples offline. Anyway, I feel the tension too, and I struggle with what to do about it. What is the prescription here? What I come back to over and over is that it's important for those of us who are disaffected to come out of the closet about it. The corporation has already poisoned the well about people like us. We're under Satan's power. We're covenant breakers. We're offended, sinning, or never had a testimony in the first place. The antidote to this corporate poison is sunlight. Being who you are, more out in the open, the more those lies will be destroyed. It's okay for true believing friends and family to be who they are, and it's okay for us apostates to be who we are as well. It's going to be all right. Probably.
So before we get into the discussion that Jay and I had, I wanted to share two clips from the butchered audio from our first attempt that I thought was actually very thoughtful and very relevant. And so after these two clips, we'll get right into the discussion.
Well, it seemed like it came up, and I sort of imagined, like, as I was listening to it, like, I imagined if I was hearing this podcast and my wife would be in the room, which, you know, she never was, but if she was, I would be uncomfortable at certain parts because at the time she was a believer and that would have offended her. And you know, if I was on the podcast, I would have maybe sighed too. And it's because of this tension between, you know, I never lost respect for the people in my life who are believers. You know, it's not like I suddenly realized that the church is false and then was like, oh my gosh, I hate all these people. I mean, it never went that way. And so, you know, you sort of have this third party in the back of your mind when you're thinking it through. You know, if I'm rejecting Mormonism, do I have to reject my grandpa at the same time? And I mean, I don't know how everybody else processes through this, but I process through it by saying, no, I don't have to reject anybody. You know, they're cool with me. I mean, I don't know how to say this and keep my, like, apostate cred or whatever, but, like, I really am fine with Mormons being exactly who they are and not giving them any crap about it.
All right, why don't we just start with the motivation, right? We talked about this on the email. The motivation for this particular topic, what sparked you going down this road with the using my auditory landmark, the Tom-Sai, as a reference or as a metaphor? So why don't you walk down with how the inspiration worked?
The thing that really kicked it off was listening to that podcast with Dan Weatherspoon and Brian Dalton, Mr. Deity, where they were basically this like slugfest where they were just duking it out for like an hour.
Yeah, it was like a verbal MMA match, dude.
Totally. And like, you know, you're just like listening to even he even says, hey, whoa, did you stop recording? And Dan Weatherspoon, who I really am impressed with that he went ahead with that particular episode. He's like, no, I'm still recording. They're just going at it with each other. And then you get to that part where he's like, yeah, you know, if I could pick my neighbors, I'd pick Mormons.
I don't know if we're still recording or not.
Well, I'm fine with leaving all this in.
Oh, okay. Okay, great.
At some point.
I would simply say this. I kind of went out of my way, or at least I tried to, at least to say that Mormons are not racist. I do not believe Mormons are racist at all. As I mentioned in the thing, that there are 27 years that I had in the church, and I don't think I ever met a racist. I think Mormons are some of the best people on the planet. If I had my druthers and I were moving into a new area and I could pick my neighbors, I would probably pick Mormons. I really like the people.
And I was like, huh, wow, that must be really, really common. And then after that, I started noticing that even outspoken critics, people that are well out of the church, have this. You know, Randy, every time his dad comes up, he's like, no, I love my dad, right? Or John Larson, if you listen to him, he's very sharp. He's got really sharp criticisms, but he still has no particular beef with individual Mormons. He's just saying, you know, I need to make a space for people who are leaving so that they don't feel crazy. And at the same time, I know how it feels, you know, listening to critics where I'm just like, whoa, hey, I'm uncomfortable with anybody talking about these people this way, right?
Right.
You know, even if it might be talking about my friends and family that I love, I don't like it, right? So there's this tension between I agree with this and, yeah, but these people I got no problem with them staying exactly the way they are, right? Over the last couple of years, I've started noticing that, that's very common. People are feeling that way. They love their Mormon friends and family, but they also have no desire to go back, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, I actually really appreciate you really making you're making a point to actually separate the criticism to the organization and not to the individuals. Because in a lot of times when I've been criticized for my beliefs, I will take that personally. So I think what you're saying is, you know, Mormons are good people. The believers, or wherever you fall on the believing spectrum, you know, you as a person, I can still love and appreciate and have a friend, you know, consider you as a friend. But it's the more the doctrine or the belief structure that you have a problem with.
Yeah, I mean, the tough thing is, and this happens all the time, is people just, you know, either it happens slowly over time or they just wake up one morning and realize, oh my gosh, you know, this is obviously not true. And I've put a lot of time and investment into it, and leaving is going to be costly. And it's, you know, I mean, you and I have both been through it probably in slightly different ways. Just you freak out for a while, you know. And I mean, I've gotten to the point where when I'm talking about it, the church online or in writing, I don't even refer to it as the church. I just call it the corporation, you know, like the corporation and I are through.
Right. Right.
But, you know, when I'm talking about Mormons, I'm almost always talking about it in positive terms.
So when you say you freaked out, you know, like, because I agree with you, there are times when you go through this phase, I guess is how you'd say it. Do you still find yourself freaking out from time to time? I mean, there's been a lot of weird stuff going on in the Mormon fringe world that's somewhat newsworthy in the last week or so.
Yeah.
Are there certain things that like trigger you? You're like, oh, I'm gonna freak out again.
No, it's been a long time, actually. I'm very comfortable with people being who they are, and you know that includes Mormons. You know, so I saw this whole thing blow up this past week about Monson getting called to testify before a British court. You know.
Yep.
I'm like, oh man, you guys are making a bigger deal than this is. I mean, Tom Phillips did that on his own. You know, there's not the, it wasn't like he organized a Facebook group and got everybody, oh yeah, you know, let's team up and get Thomas S. Monson to come and testify for fraud or whatever. Like, A, he did it without anybody's help, and B, he's got it. And C, we don't even know if it's going anywhere, so just let's wait and see what happens with it before getting all excited about it. That's, you know, that's how I see it.
But it's so fun to speculate, Jay. I mean, it's time to freak out, man. There's things are brewing.
When I was saying freak out, I was more talking about just like, you know, being afraid that I might lose my wife. You know, what if
this means
I got to get divorced, or just being so angry about feeling misled or whatever. I'm over all that. And to be fair, for like a couple of years, if anybody would have asked me, I would have said, oh yeah, I'm over the most of the angry stuff. But that was not true for 2 years. Every time I said it, it was not true. I thought it was true, but it took at least a couple of years before I really got through a lot of the thrashing.
How long do you think that process was for you? Because I haven't really put a time frame on from beginning to end when I really felt the disaffection take root to where I felt like, you know, you have that moment of settling in, like, okay, well, this is how it's going to be from now on. And then you kind of take that first step forward. How long was that for you?
Oh, man, it's really hard to say because I sort of had little baby steps of little mini faith crises along the way, starting in college. But I was always very loyal to the corporation until one day I went to work and somebody sent me an email, and it was a link to RFM, exmormon.org, and it was an relatively innocuous post, and I just started clicking from there. So I came home from work that day in a faith crisis.
Wow.
And I don't know how it goes for everybody else, but and then it took probably at least 2.5 years to, and basically what really got me out of the emotional pain was several months of counseling, which I highly recommend.
Right. Yeah, I've been through the counseling thing too, and I definitely recommend it. For those, you know, for those people that are considering it, I would strongly consider you at least exploring it. Try to find a therapist that will work with you. Don't give up. You know, if you might get a therapist that isn't supportive or you don't feel like is listening properly. There's so many of them out there that I imagine you can find one that right. will work with you.
And, you know, maybe I was lucky, but I dealt with two, and both of them were fantastic. So,
cool. Whatever. All right. So let's go back to the essay a little bit where you talk about Mormons are salt of the earth. You would, you definitely think that they're some of the best people out there. And I think you even make reference to when you were at BYU or you were working for BYU that you would definitely go out of your way to hire a BYU grad.
Yeah. Okay. So the broader point is that if I'm in a position to hire somebody or whatever, and I find out that person is LDS, it's definitely a point in their favor automatically. You know, there might be other things where I would pick another individual, but just being Mormon, that is, for me anyway, a point in someone's favor. But for my particular profession specifically, there were only three programs in the country for facilities management, and BYU is the best one. So in that particular field, you can either hire an engineer, which is quite expensive comparatively, or you can hire a BYU person, or you can hire somebody who's highly likely not to be qualified. Right. So,
so in your experience, maybe not necessarily BYU grad, but just Mormons in general have a good work ethic or dependable and, like you said, loyal. Is that how you kind of define it?
Just in general, I've had very positive experiences. You know, even after my faith crisis, it's just one of those things that's. And a lot of it is just this, you know, 30 years of my family, my parents, my aunts and uncles, grandparents, and everything who are just, I mean, there's just no other way to say it. They're just wonderful, you know. And, you know, so that's the thing I just automatically go to when I think of Mormons, you know. It's like, what's not to like?
Well, I mean, what's not to like? I mean, are you telling me that you haven't come across any dicks that are believers?
Yeah, I have. It's just
okay.
There's a bell curve, acceptable humans, and Mormons for me tend to be on the good side generally.
All right, yeah. So the majority of them are not dicks. I can
get behind that.
Yeah, I like that. So let's talk a little bit about where you started to go down your long family roots in Mormonism or whatever, that you talked a lot about your grandparents, some of your ancestral ties to deep Mormon roots.
Sure. It is not difficult for me to go through and just find cool stories. I focused in on my grandpa because he's no longer alive, and so he isn't going to be embarrassed about me talking about him on a podcast like this or whatever. But my aunts and uncles who are still alive, I could go through listing similar stories, and my cousins are just solid people. Like, if you know, if you knew, I don't think you know any of my cousins or whatever, but they're just awesome. And even like Briners, in Salt Lake City, there's a lot of Briners, and most of them are not related to me except for like fairly distantly. So I've never really gotten to know them. And, a lot of times when people are like, "Oh, your last name is Briner. Do you know Professor Briner that used to teach at BYU? That guy was so awesome." And I didn't not know that person, but that's just how it goes, you know?
Right. I seem to get that with my name. Like, you know, my name's pretty prevalent around. There's a lot of parallels, but, you know, I tried to be pretty forthcoming by saying, no, I'm not related. But, you know, if I get caught in that really tired mode, like I've just been berated, there's the occasional moment where I'll just slip and say, yeah, you know, he's my grandpa. He holds out. He holds out on Christmas, but it's always good to see him during general conference. I don't know. I'm kind of a dick that way sometimes.
Oh, so have I got some stories for you.
He told me he doesn't really believe. Do you believe it? No. So you served a mission, right?
Yeah, I served in Phoenix. And I mentioned this in my little essay there, that my mission president was actually very cool. You know, like, easily the coolest one out of my circle of friends that went on missions. Like, he did nothing of the sort of, like, the psychological torture stuff that mission presidents do.
Really?
No, he was like a university administrator, so he'd worked with college age kids all the time, you know, his whole career basically. So he knew how to, you know, what kind of things to emphasize and what kind of things not to. And
he wasn't like a obedience monger where he's like, you guys got to follow the rules or else, that kind of thing.
No, not at all. Like, it wasn't like he was like, oh yeah, yeah, sure, go break all the rules or anything. It wasn't like that. But like, well, just to give one example, in interviews, he noticed, he was asking people, like, you know, do you feel like you're worthy to be on a mission? And a lot of them were saying no. And it's like, well, why not? And they always said, or a lot of them were saying, besides the obvious, you know, like, oh, I was masturbating, you know, they were saying, I'm listening to music that's not approved. And so finally he's just like, look, if you're listening to music that's not approved, bring the CD into your interview at Zone Conference and I'll either approve it or I won't. Right.
Holy cow, dude.
And he approved every single one that I know of, you know? So
come on.
It's just like, this is not worth feeling crappy about. And let's work on that. And there was lots of stuff like that. It wasn't like the mission was out of control or anything. It was just, the point was, I have nothing to complain about as far as like growing up Mormon. I had a great experience. At the time I wasn't saying, oh yeah, this is definitely going to be the best 2 years of my life or anything. But as far as missions go, I was in Phoenix, so I had dinner appointments every night, and my mission president was pretty nice and pretty good, and whatever. Phoenix, what's to complain about?
Well, okay, show off. I'm glad you enjoyed it. I mean,
Where'd you go?
I went to Peoria, Illinois.
Oh yeah, okay. Meth labs and Caterpillar.
What?
There's like Caterpillar factories, right?
Oh yeah, that's right. Yeah, and Morton, I think.
And
I don't know if it's still there.
What I understand from living in down the road at another factory town, Peoria at least has a reputation for lots of drugs.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of some other places because our mission was pretty vast. I served in Burlington, Iowa, and I served in Kirksville, Missouri.
Oh my gosh, that's huge.
Springfield, Decatur. It was good times. I mean, as far as geographical, and I had lots of really good companions. But my mission president, I think what I didn't like about him is the politics, the way he kind of was involved in that. But, I mean, you probably didn't deal with politics. Sounds like
my mission president was a good guy. I've just literally, as far as missions go, I lucked out big time. So.
All right, so let's I want to go to the next one that is on my list here, is where you started to compare the LDS Church, or as you call it, the corporation, and use the metaphor of a cheating spouse.
Okay.
And even in your essay, it sounded like you were a little reluctant of using that analogy, but you went ahead with it anyways.
It wasn't that I was reluctant. I was feeling like.
Well, you should have been reluctant, dude. That's a pretty explicit analogy, or it can raise eyebrows.
That's the one. That's my go-to analogy. If anybody wants my opinion about, you know, what the deal is, that's the analogy I use. Is, and I'll stand by that. You know, I challenge anybody to go online and go find a discussion forum where people who've been cheated on by a spouse are talking to each other about it, and how they describe it. You know, they totally trusted their spouse. They were totally caught off guard.
They feel violated.
The spouse demanded 100% loyalty. The spouse lied behind their back, didn't tell them the truth, took their money, blamed them for everything whenever there's an issue. And just see if the parallel doesn't follow. I mean, for me, it does. You know, you see these essays coming out recently. You know, they've known about that stuff for 150 years, and the average chapel attending Mormon does not know about this stuff, right?
Right. And, yeah. Either willfully or ignorantly. Yeah. Yeah.
And now they're just anonymously releasing these essays to sort of like plausibly, deniably come out with the truth. And there's a concept in the infidelity discussion called trickle truth, where they're like, yeah, well, you know, I have to tell you something, honey. I went out to dinner with my secretary and we kissed. And then the spouse is like, oh, no, are you serious? I can't believe you would do that. And then, like, it comes out a couple weeks later, like, yeah, well, they actually, you know, made out in the back of the car after dinner, and then you find out that they've been going to hotels and having sex for 6 months, you know. we're just gonna like dribble the truth out bit by bit until when you eventually find the whole story, it resembles nothing like the original story that they were telling, you know.
So then, yeah, you get caught up in these web of lies, like, I can never trust you again, and what am I supposed to do now? And yeah.
So trickle truth. That's what I call these essays coming out anonymously, not date stamped or time stamped, no author showing
well,
up.
Well, no author, but I mean, isn't it assumed that, you know, the first presidency, obviously Mike T will disagree, but you know, it's supposed to be the first presidency that's supposedly the author, right?
I bet they sign off on it, but whatever. I mean, why isn't this stuff in like Doctrines of Salvation published 60 years ago, right?
Because
nobody believes this crap. Tell them the story, right? You know, you go around and you have missionary discussions. Oh yeah, you know, isn't it wonderful? Isn't it marvelous that families can be forever, just like Joseph Smith and his 33 wives aged 14 to 45, and sometimes he sent these guys on missions and married with their wife while the husband was gone. I mean, good luck with that one, right?
Right.
Why don't they tell the whole story? Maybe they're lying about it. Maybe they're just putting their best foot forward. But whatever you call it, if they're telling the whole story, it's not going to work, right? You know why they do it.
Right.
People don't hand over their lives to a corporation with the whole story when it's this story.
Well, this is kind of... This is kind of related, but it's kind of a little off topic, so humor me a little bit. So let's say your grandpa's still alive and he's reasonably healthy, and the two of you have a pretty good relationship. And would you at all at some point feel comfortable or motivated to say, hey, Grandpa, have you seen some of these essays? Maybe like start planting seeds. Would you do that? Or do you feel like, you know, I just have to let sleeping dogs lie. I don't want to go there kind of thing.
So the way I see it is like, okay, all right, let's use my grandpa for an example, right, who I love. He got married, had kids. He was there for his kids the whole time. He had a job. He paid off his mortgage. You know, he bought groceries, made sure they got their dental appointments. The kids grew up, went to college, had families of their own that were great.
The perfect grandpa, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Success. What do I want from him additionally, right? Do I really want him to change anything? No, right? Stay exactly the way you are. That's fine with me, right? Just like if I had a next-door neighbor who was Catholic who did the exact same thing, it's not like I'm going to go planting seeds. Hey, what do you think about that, you know, this recent scandal, you know? No, I'm not going to do anything, right? Unless they want my help, right? You're doing great. And same thing goes for, like, my aunts and uncles who – it's the exact same story. You know, all my cousins have pretty much all grown up, gone to college, gotten married, and are now having families of their own. I don't really have any desire to go in and mess with that, right? But what I do want to do is, like, be out in the closet enough – so that if any of my cousins or aunts and uncles or nieces and nephews, whatever, do have some sort of disaffection or whatever, they don't feel like they're crazy and alone. They can find me. They can know about me, and I can, you know, walk them through it.
Yeah, this is actually, you know, one of the more telling parts of the essay for me is where you kind of sounded like you were trying to be a champion for the closeted unbelievers by saying, you guys need to come out. And
yeah, like,
this goes to what you were just saying, that you want to be out, but you don't want to be out so far as to look and sound threatening, I guess, to your friends and family that are believers, but you want to create kind of a safe zone for maybe other closeted doubters. Is that what you're thinking?
Yeah, like, I've been in a handful of conversations with Heather C. from Mormon Expositor. And just, you know, what's the way to do this? You know, the whole come out of the closet. And for me, anyway, what I say is, this is not worth having your life go to pieces over, right? Like, if you're going to get divorced or if your parents are going to kick you out of the house or whatever, just go to church, you know? It's not worth it. Drift away in a way that's not going to screw your life up, right? But, like, when I was having those conversations with Heather, I had this other conversation with a different friend. And there's this LDS family that I know, and there's like five kids in the family, and I know three of them, right? It's a fairly well-known LDS name. Like, a lot of people would recognize this family. And the youngest kid in this family, who I don't know, I noticed was mutual friends with one of my ex-Mormon pals, right?
Uh-oh.
And I was like, hey, how do you know this person? The ex-Mormon pal was like, oh, yeah, that person's a closet disbeliever, you know? Doesn't believe it at all, but doesn't want the rest of the family to find out about it. So, and I was like, that would make sense to me, you know? I see why this sibling would like to remain quiet about this, because one of the siblings, I know for a fact, goes on a lot of these, like, apologetic discussion boards and is quite strident in defense of the faith, you know? And I was just like, oh, man, that must just be horrible to feel alone in your own family. And what if I've got a cousin that's like that? You know, what's my job here? Right. And so I need to have the balls to be out in the open enough that person doesn't, a year from now, 5 years from now, the price is less of leaving. The threat level, the little red flags that pop up in people's brains are fewer. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. You don't think the church is true anymore? Yeah, yeah, that's just like Jay. Okay. All right. Just don't start doing drugs. Okay. You know, just, and the other thing is, ex-Mormons who are past the thrashing and the angry stage can use their words and say, yeah, you know, I love you, you know, to their friends and family, and make it known that you don't have to change for me. You know?
So I guess my question to you is when you were going through this, was there someone that you reached out to that was in your safe zone where you started to, I don't know, you're taking your baby steps out as a disbeliever? Was there someone that you could reach out to and say, hey, I'm all alone. I got nobody to talk to. Obviously, you had your, you know, you went to therapy and whatnot, but was there someone in your family or in your friend circles or maybe someone online that you could reach out to kind of vent? Like, dude, can I just talk to you for a minute kind of thing?
Yeah, as far as I know, in my own family, other than some outliers who do fit into the stereotypes of people who leave the church, I'm just the only one. As far as I can tell, my extended family is true blue believer.
Really?
Yeah. This is immature, but I went on Facebook and just like went through my LDS friends, and anybody that had alcohol in a picture, I like sent them a message.
Are you serious? What was the message like? Hey,
I was just like, hey, did you leave Mormonism? Because if you did, I want to know why. And then, and then like nobody responded to me. And then like a week later, I was like, hey, how come you haven't responded to me? I see you're online all the time. I really need to know because I'm freaking out here. I don't think it's true, and I need to talk to somebody. And it turns out all of them were just afraid that I was going to be all judgy on them, you know?
Ah, yeah.
So,
can you blame them? I mean, no. That's kind of the culture. Yeah.
So I had a few phone conversations about that. And basically it took a while, you know, but I had people in my corner. I knew there were other people out there. And then especially these online resources with the, you know, the backlog of podcasts about people talking about it and stuff. This really helped me to feel like I wasn't crazy. You know, mission accomplished. Mormon expression. Thank you.
Yeah, because you spent a little bit of time on your essay at the very beginning thanking the Mormon podcast world out there, right? Where,
yeah.
And so when you were going through it, you started grinding through podcasts and that started helping a little bit?
Yeah, the one I first stumbled on was John DeLynn. And it was like, oh, yeah, this is exactly what I want to do. I want to go find all these primary sources. And then I stumbled on Mormon Expression, and it was just very stereotypical. At first, it was too harsh for me, and I stopped listening to it for a few months, and I came back to it. And then,
yeah. I think most of us that are, you know, somewhat or semi-involved in the podcast world, you know, you kind of go through the DeLynn stage, and then you go branch out to some of the other stages. I don't even listen to Apologetics one. Did you ever try that one? What was it, the Faircast or something like that?
Absolutely not.
Okay.
I can't handle that. In fact, I wouldn't have even been able to handle it when I was a BYU student.
Why wouldn't you have been able to handle it as a BYU student, man? Come on.
Because there were people I knew at BYU that I was very close to that sort of just nudged me into a reluctant liberal Mormon. You know, just
really
just from like, I don't know, you can't think of it that way. We did this electroshock therapy on gay people for however many years. It doesn't work, you know.
Really?
You want to do that? Yeah. So, you know, there's a lot of groupthink at BYU, but it's also, for me at least, it turned me into a much more liberal Mormon than I arrived as.
That's funny because, yeah, my experience was – every time I started to feel like I wanted to go a little more liberal, you know, like, ooh, I think I want to watch an R-rated movie or go golf on Sunday. I would always be overwhelmed with guilt. And I had a kind of a father figure. He was a priest quorum advisor and a scout leader and whatever. And I still vividly remember when I was leaving church early, he's like, hey, where are you going? He grabs my arm. I was like, oh, I'm going to meet up with two of my friends and go golfing. And he stares me down. And he says, you know, it's a Sabbath, right? And I said, yeah. He's like, you're going to go golfing on Sunday? And then he looked right down on the floor and he started shaking his head. And dude, I can't remember the last time I felt so shitty. I mean, I turned to my buddy and I said, hey man, you're just going to have to go on without me. And so I went to priest quorum, whatever it was, elders quorum. And he was so proud of me, you know. I faced the adversary right in the eye, and I said, "No, thank you, sir."
Nailed it.
And you know, my friends are like, "What the hell's wrong with Tom?"
Dude, it's a slippery slope. You know, you do 9 holes on a Sunday, and then like 6 months later, you're
sleeping with
animals. Die of heroin in your apartment.
Yes. I was going to say sleeping with animals or, yeah, you've got a heroin needle in your arm. Exactly. It's so ridiculous to think about it now, but yeah, that's totally how my mind was back then. And it didn't help that I had kind of the leaders that you can't even start down that path, dude. You just can't even do it. So in a lot of ways, I'm freaking jealous that you were you kind of eased into liberal Mormonism so easy. For me, it was a very, very tough thing to do. And then when I finally did, I said, what the hell am I doing? Picking and choosing. Who does this?
Like the way I describe the way I describe it is like the pendulum. Have you heard me talk about that? You and I talked about that.
Like, I can't remember. Go ahead again, just in case.
It's like it's very tempting to take the scriptures at face value. You know, it just exactly what it is says it right there. That's what I believe, right? But the problem.
How's that tempting though? That's what does that mean? Like that's the only way I can see it.
That's what I call like the fundamentalist thing, and it's just very seductive, right? Like, hey, God says believe in the Bible, believe in the Book of Mormon, that's enough, right? And then so the problem with that is you have to believe things that are just obviously not true, right? And your brain gets tired of it, right? So like right. You know, Noah's Ark is a thing. Wait, that's obviously not true. Or you know, God changes people's skin color as a punishment. Well, that doesn't work that way. And so what happens is the pendulum swings over to the other side, which I call the liberal belief system, right? Where you sort of, oh, we're just going to take this as a metaphor. We're going to think of this as an allegorical story. We're going to emphasize this scripture over here in this section, and we're going to de-emphasize this other scripture or reinterpret it or just completely ignore it. And that's way better, right? Until you realize that, hey, I can make the Bible say whatever I want it to say.
Yeah, speaking of slippery slopes, right, yeah, exactly.
Right, and then you're like, oh, no, I better get down to basics. And then you swing back over to the fundamentalist side, and then you're stuck in this, like, swinging back and forth. Okay, well, now we're going to take this literal, and then you get so good at it that you can do it, like, instantaneously, whatever you need in this particular situation. And then after a while, for me at least, it's just – the pendulum falls from the ceiling and boom, you're in a faith crisis. Oh, sorry. So that's,
well, there's only so much your brain can handle. At least, I mean, this is the experience that I've had. Yeah. I think your metaphor is perfect because that's exactly how it went for me. Like I would start to justify a few things and then I would only need a few triggers, you know, or one good seminary teacher or a gospel doctrine teacher to say, you can't even face the slightest shade of evil or whatever it is.
Right.
Once you let him in the door, what's that the camel in the tent metaphor?
And then pretty soon you're out in the barn with Fanny Alger. And then what? Then what are you going to do? Right.
Exactly.
You're in Satan's power.
There's even when I think about it right now, I think there's truth to that, Jay. No shit. Oh. And it's freaky.
Yeah, I mean, especially for like teenagers and stuff. Like, I'm pretty tolerant of even like fairly conservative families and stuff. There's a lot to be said to making it to age 21 without drinking. You know, if you can make it till your mid 20s without getting somebody pregnant, you're gonna be way better off. You know, and whatever they gotta say so that your prefrontal cortex develops before you start making a lot of these decisions. Probably better, not necessarily for everybody, but you know, you can see how that makes sense to people.
Right. And
so that's another reason why I'm just, you got a family, your kids grew up, they go to college, they get married, make something out of their lives. I'm basically not going to give you crap about anything. You know, now I'm like making it sound like everybody has to be perfect or whatever. I'm just thinking about like my aunts and uncles who I'm like, they do not have to change for me, right? Just because I changed my mind about the truthfulness of Mormonism doesn't mean I changed my mind about them. I did not.
Okay.
That's what I'm saying. I'm not saying like somebody made a bad decision when they were 17 or something. I'm not saying you suck or whatever. I'm just saying I'm thinking of these people that are, they're still LDS that are like, hey, what did I do? Why are you criticizing my religion?
Right.
I'm not criticizing you at all.
You're fairly active in the ex-Mormon crowd online or whatever, and you've seen this kind of behavior before, and this is to go back to you you know, calling out the closeted unbelievers to come out, make a safe zone for other closeted disbelievers. But don't you see a phenomena that happens where, because we're so programmed in Mormon culture, every member a missionary, you know, you're constantly trying to convert, you know, if your neighbor is a non-member or inactive, it's constantly on your mind, like, well, how can I fellowship them? Or how can I bring them to church? You know, so your mind's always programmed, like, I got to bring them to where I'm at now. So when the table gets flipped and then you learn the truth and you don't believe in the church anymore, a lot of people fall into that trap where just the roles get reversed and they're like, oh, so now I got to bring people to where I'm at now. I got to show them the truth, you know? And it's like they want to run into the chapel and say, F this, who's coming with me? You know, this is not true. You see this all the time, right?
Yeah. 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 Totally. Like, oh, so, hey, you know, what if I can just craft this email to my relative, to this relative of mine who just made a snarky thing on Facebook, you know, that's not what you should be saying to your brother or whatever, you know. Just, it's two separate issues, you know, whether Mormonism is true or whether, here's how I, not that I'm like, you know, supposedly the model, I'm not trying to make myself a model or whatever, but like the filter I use for whether I'm going to say anything is I always just like take a second and say, huh, would I do this with my Catholic neighbor? Would I try and work something into the conversation about how Catholicism is baloney? No, I almost never would do that, right? So it's okay to almost never do that with your Mormon family and friends. If they want to know, they'll talk to you about it.
Right.
And it'll be a straightforward conversation. And then the first thing you've got to do is you've got to come to a level of respect, you know? Hey, right. Wherever this conversation goes, I respect you, and you have every right to disagree with my opinion without me thinking you're stupid or whatever.
Right.
And then, you know, once that threshold of respect has been met, you can talk and you can lay it out. You know, you can cut loose and say whatever you want to say. They've got to want to have that conversation, number one, and then you have to communicate the respect. And that's how I see it anyways. It's most people don't want to talk about this. Like, most people don't have this huge mental problem with, you know, the religion they grew up with. They're doing fine, or they've got other problems to deal with. They're worried about, like, their job, or they're getting the mortgage paid, or taxing the kids all around to football or whatever. You know, so they got other issues. They don't need to sit there and fix your mental problems with Mormonism. You know, they've got other deals. And in fact, I'll go even so far. I'll take it even a step further. There are people who are perfectly happy sitting in the pews, doing callings, paying tithing, who do not believe Mormonism is true. They're there. They're happy to be there. They already don't believe, and it doesn't matter, you know?
Yep, I can attest to that.
So it's not your job, you know? Like, you can be who you are as an apostate, right? You're fine the way you are, but everybody else, it's okay for them to believe what they want to believe. And, you know, a lot of times, definitely I felt this in like the ex-Mormon crowds, like, oh yeah, I'm better than that, you know, I'm skeptical of truth claims or whatever, and then they come out with just a small contingent or whatever, but like just crazy theories about whatever, like, oh yeah, you know, I don't vaccinate with the flu shot, you know, I don't believe in that or whatever. Okay, you know, the data's right there for the flu shot, you know, you it's safe and it will help, but
yeah, that's very risky, and I don't approve of it, but whatever.
Yeah. Exactly. I mean,
no,
I just picked out vaccines out of the air, but
no, I totally get that. But in, you know, the examples and what you just laid down, I think is very mature and wise. I wish I could say that I did that, but I was that guy who switched, and I had to send off the mass email with 32 pages of documented proof that the church was not true. I actually did the air bunnies when I said that. You believe that? And so, I was kind of like, come on, you guys, who's coming with me? This is a bunch of BS. And that just caused rifts everywhere. I mean, that's essentially me emailing saying, hey, here I am to burn bridges. So whatever relationship we had, here's me driving wedges in between it. How does that feel?
Yeah, like, okay, would I do that to my neighbors, right? Like, okay, I've got a street. There's probably 20 people that live on my street. Would I send an email to every one of them and say, hey, you know what? your religion, it's bull crap. You know, you should not do it. No, I would never send that email. So why would I say that to my Mormon friends?
But both you and I have seen a lot of people go through these circles and these communities that do this, that feel like you don't have integrity, Jay, until you do that. Stand up for what you, quote, believe or not believe and be an example, you know, burn bridges if you must.
Yeah, I disagree with that, you know. So.
Yeah, I'm with you too, man. I had to learn the hard way. You were too smart. I had to
learn. Let me clarify. I was not too smart. I was a butthole plenty of times. Like, for example, for the first 6 months, anytime home teachers would come over, I'd get all angry and blurt things out in the conversation or whatever. And this one time, I remember the home teachers were talking about something else, and I was like, you know what I want to talk about? I want to talk about the Jupiter talisman. You know?
Did you really?
Yeah. Afterwards, my wife was just like, "What is wrong with you? Right? Did you turn into an alien or something? This is not like you." They didn't even want to talk about this. You know, can you like please not turn into an asshole? Which of course it was too late, right?
You're like, I'm wearing my assholery on my sleeve. Thank you very much.
Right. So, and I think one marker of like, you know, people disaffect from the corporation, right? And then they freak out and they go through this process of whatever it is. And then I think one good marker of knowing how far the emotional healing is going is like you talk to Mormons, right? And if you can like talk to them and like not get all emotionally pissed off when they talk about how the Book of Abraham proves that Joseph Smith can translate ancient documents or whatever, if you can like impassionately have a conversation and like not take the bait, right? And you've moved on, right? And that's where you want to get. You want to get to the point of indifference and let people be who they are. That's like an explicit rule in my family. People get to be who they are. If you're gay, you get to be gay. I'm not going to give any crap about it. If you're Mormon, I'm not going to give you any crap about it. If you're atheist, good, right? You get to be who you are. And as long as you're not hurting anybody, you're good.
So here's some symptoms or some things to watch for when you know you're taking the bait, as you said. If they start to preach to you and say, you know, let's turn to Moses chapter 4. If you find yourself rolling your eyes and doing the, quote, Tom sigh, you know that you know you're just about to take the bait. I mean, I know this from my own experience. It's like when my home teacher says, "Okay, have you read the home teaching message in the end sign?" And I give him that glare, like, "Really?
Wait. You still get home teachers?"
You bet.
Oh yeah. Okay.
I still go. I mean, not reg. I guess we'd have to define what regular means. So.
And then how do you see, like, you know, sometimes I hear ex-Mormons talking about, like, oh, I don't want my kids to get indoctrinated. How do you see that? Do you see that as a threat or a concern?
Yes. Well, in some sense, I do. But I think I mentioned this on a podcast, so forgive me if I'm repeating myself. But if my daughter, she opted out of going to seminary. And that was actually one of the biggest things that concerned me or got me a little bit worried, because I reflect back on my life and some of the more impactful moments in my life was seminary. That actually brought me into a more structured belief system, I guess, where I could actually recall when I started to pray and read the scriptures on my own. And a lot of that was seminary inspired. And I had this one seminary teacher who was absolutely phenomenal. And he like took me under his wing. He was such a good guy, just a phenomenal guy. And he helped motivate me to want to go on a mission. And so a lot of seeds are being planted back then for me. And so, yeah, I get a little concerned that my daughter, if she did go to seminary, that I feel like she would end up down that same path. So regardless of my influence, you know, me being the parent, it all depends on whether I can be that other side, that other influence. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So it becomes like this push-pull atmosphere for her. And I just didn't want her
to have to go through that. And I didn't want to have to go through that, where I'd have to up my game, you know, like I'd be standing in the doorway as she walks home from seminary and say, okay, so now I'm going to spend the next 45 minutes deprogramming everything you just learned about. Like, let's debunk a lot of this BS that you just learned. I just didn't want to have to go through that. So in one sense, I do understand that. It's just a tug of war, man. It's a difficult thing with kids, because I know the parents' influence is by far and away the most influential thing. And so there should be like this level of trust that you should be able to give and say, whatever happens, whatever you learn or whatever, that's fine. But always come back to me and we'll, you know, I'll create this safe atmosphere so you can let it all out and we can talk it out, and that'll be great. But sometimes, like in my situation, I became so close and so enamored with my seminary president and with my priest quorum advisor and whatever, that they were a much bigger influence on me spiritually than even my own father and my mother was. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, this turned out not to be an issue for my family, because I basically stopped doing callings when my dad had to end up baptizing my son, my 8-year-old, and then
when did that happen?
My son is 10 and a half, so that was 2.5 years ago.
Okay.
You were on a forum when I posted it. I was like, oh, man, this really hurt a lot more than I thought it was going to. And then you were the first comment. You're like, I feel your pain, man. That was basically it for me. You know, I sort of tried to do the whole New Order Mormon thing. I'm not going to be dishonest. I'm just going to be all fringy, but I'll participate and do callings and stuff. And I felt like an outsider. And that's another thing. Like, the church has like this window. People don't want to leave, right? So if they can get you into a safe, comfortable spot on the fringe during that window, then not. But if they can't do it within whatever, the 6 months or whatever, you know, those people are not coming back. Anyway, where was I? What was I talking about on that? Oh, with my kids. I never thought the church could be powerful enough to win that argument, but I didn't have teenagers either, so.
So let's go back. You said about 2 years ago or something like that, your son was baptized and you had your dad baptize him?
Yeah.
And so you feel like that move or that decision for you to not baptize him, that was kind of a signal to, I don't know, your family, your kids, all the above, that this is kind of where you draw the line in the sand, or I don't know. Explain that a little bit.
Let's see. What happened was, and this is the way I remember it, my wife might see it a little bit differently, but like at the time, my brother was living with me. He was getting ready to go on his mission. I knew that I was supportive, right, of his decision to go, and you know, letting him use my car to go to work and stuff. And he, during one of his interviews with the bishop, he sort of said something that was a little bit too fringy.
Okay.
And then the bishop called me into the office and was like, Sam said some things that were a little bit, and I was like, oh, no. I just sort of was like, what do you want to know? You know?
So did the bishop talk to you because he thought, oh, Jay's got to him, like that?
That was when, like, yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
Great.
And then it ended up, me not being able to baptize my son. And they were sort of like, oh, well, let's wait a few months and see or whatever. And I was like, no, we're not waiting. You know, my dad can come and do this. We're not going to make my kid feel weird for, you know, not being the only 8-year-old in primary that hasn't gotten baptized yet because his dad has problems or whatever. I'm not doing that. But it really made me feel like an outsider, not participating in any of that stuff. And that was basically like the decision point where I was like, okay, this is pretty much it for me.
Anyone for the closing prayer?
Now, if any of you guys are still playing that stupid game, I'll bet you're drunk after this podcast.